Now count to 10.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
We're interviewing Tom Rolfe at his home in Helena, Montana on September, what is it, 28th? 27th, 2005. Tom was a member of the Montana State Legislature. We're interviewing Tom Rolfe, who, this is September 27th, 2005, and I'm interviewing Tom Rolfe at his home in Helena, Montana. Tom Rolfe was a member of the Montana House of Representatives from 1972 to 1974, and also a leader in the conservative movement in the state of Montana, active in the nomination of President Ronald Reagan, also involved in the Goldwater movement in the 1960s. Tom, you grew up in Bozeman, and you were active as a leader in the Teenage Republican Club, and also importantly as a leader in the conservative movement. What got you interested in politics?
Well, I've often said that I had a couple of young friends that were probably older than their age would indicate, and they started talking to me about politics. One of them, Blair Strong, was always far too serious for being 10 years old, and I remember the conversation that we had when he had finally convinced me that I should be a Republican and a conservative. And then his next task was to convince me to do something about it. And I'll never forget the words that he said. You know, he said, "We're in fifth grade, Tom. We are 10 years old. It's time we get serious about this."
And Blair was what? Was he the grandson of Dean Chaffin?
Right. He's the grandson of Dean Chaffin, who was a member of the Montana House of Representatives, a Speaker of the House, I think, and then later a candidate for Lieutenant Governor. Dean was also the only Montanan to be the national president of the Automobile Dealers Association.
So Blair had this family connection to politics.
Mm-hmm.
And you were a personal friend of his in grade school.
Right.
And so he convinced you. Was there anything about conservatism and the Republican Party philosophy that you remember when you were...
Well, the thing I remember more than anything else is just the whole idea of freedom. And that it seemed like more rules and more controls took away freedom, and that got in the way of people making good decisions, and I think that the whole thing just centered around what made the most freedom for the most largest number of people. And that's what sort of made sense to me.
Were you involved at all? Do you remember anything about the Kennedy-Nixon campaign in 1960?
The only thing I remember about that campaign actually was more related to the governor's campaign when Don Nutter, it was probably the first thing I ever did in politics. Another friend of the same age, his father was very active in the Nutter campaign, and then they talked me into going on a torchlight parade, probably one of the last ones ever held in Montana in 1960 for Nutter, and we started over, I think, on the east side of Bozeman and wound our way up Main Street and wound up at the Emerson School, where Nutter made a speech, and then there was a reception afterwards, and I got to go up and shake his hand, but I really remember meeting the galloping Swede that night for the first time. This great big hulk of a man with a Swedish accent, who was currently governor, and he was trying to pass the mantle on over to Don Nutter, who also became governor. But I think that was probably my first political act, you know, is to be in that torchlight parade just before the election of 1960.
Do you remember the impression that Nutter's speech may have left? Do you remember?
I remember the man being kind of tense and full of energy. And I don't remember a lot about what he said, but
But he was forceful, dynamic.
Yeah, to me, and he really believed. You could tell he really believed what he was talking about. And he again reiterated that theme of freedom and less government and more freedom for the individual, which really resonated for me.
So you continued your interest in politics. You know, you were excited by that experience in 1960, and then you, the focus of conservatives in the Republican Party in Montana was on nominating Senator Barry Goldwater in
mm-hmm.
1964.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember about that? Of course, it was a contest between Goldwater and Rockefeller for the Republican nomination.
Yes, and in late '63, there were my friends, my friend Blair Strong again, talked me into joining a new group that was starting up called the Teenage Republicans, and we got involved in helping that effort and most all of my friends were very strong Goldwater supporters, and it was an interesting thing in Bozeman because during that same election, Governor Nutter had died and Governor Babcock had become governor, and the president of the college in Bozeman his name was Roland Rennie, was running as the Democrat for governor
in 1964.
So that there were quite a few people who were pretty conservative that were supporting Reagan, but because of because of knowing Rennie so well from being in the community, were also supporting Rennie. And I couldn't understand that because everything I'd read about Rennie and everything I knew about Rennie is that he did not believe in freedom for the individual, that he believed in more government controls and a bigger government solving problems and getting in the way and taxing people more and everything. And so I couldn't understand that deal, but I think it was through personal friendship that was happening. When I got very involved in during the general election campaign after Goldwater had been nominated, I remember getting all excited and putting out yard signs, and I had to have three or four yard signs in our yard for Goldwater and then for Governor Babcock. And one of our neighbors who had really, as far as I knew, didn't have much involvement in politics, but he had worked at the university with Rennie, and he came over to try to convince my father that it would be just was the wrong thing for us to not support Rennie. And my dad would not change. Wouldn't change. And I don't know whether I think my dad probably voted for Babcock because that's where his leanings were. But he wouldn't make me take down the signs for Babcock, you know, and put up the Rennie signs, uh-huh. like the neighbor was really pushing him to do.
Yeah.
And that neighbor happened to be Hugo Eck. He made a concerted effort to promote. Of course, his wife, his widow Dorothy, has been real involved in Democrat politics.
State Senator Dorothy Eck from Bozeman,
yeah.
was a Democratic state senator for many years after
yeah.
that. Tom, do you remember the Young Americans for Freedom? Were you involved with that group at all?
Not really too much. I remember hearing about them. I remember reading some of the things that came out around when they organized what they called the Sharon Statement and whatnot from Sharon, Connecticut meeting. But I was never really involved in that. I was so involved with the Teenage Republicans that took up all my time. One of my fond memories, I just happened to think of something that happened. I worked on my folks' ranch during the summer, and I really wanted to be at the Republican convention in 1964 because I just knew that Goldwater was the answer to all of our problems, you know. And so I remember I was driving a tractor from one ranch piece of ranch land over to another during the nomination speeches, and I had a little transistor radio up to my ear so that I could hear the speeches for Goldwater, and I was just elated to be able to hear what was going on.
And you would have been about a high school?
I was 15 years old. I suppose
sophomore?
That. Yeah, some. Actually, probably I was ended being a freshman. Started my sophomore year that fall. Yeah. Yeah.
Was there anything, you know, when you think about it, the Republican nominees for president in the 40s and 50s and 60s and so on had been people who perhaps weren't necessarily Westerners or who weren't in touch with the West?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking like Wendell Willkie and Governor Tom Dewey and General Eisenhower, and to some extent even Richard Nixon, who later went on to be president, even though from California, was, I think, not considered so much a Westerner like
mm-hmm.
Goldwater.
Mm-hmm.
And well, Goldwater's conservatism was something he was proud of and something that resonated with grassroots Republicans. Do you suppose that there was a somewhat of a feeling on the part of Heartland and perhaps Western Republicans that it was time to throw overboard the country clubbers and the Eastern establishment?
Yeah, I remember that very clearly, that there was a group of people who just felt like everything had been run from the East, the population centers of the country, and they had kind of run roughshod over the folks from the West. That many times, I think maybe kind of went along with the feeling that many times the big corporations were from the East, that came out and dominated us politically in the West, you know. And so there was a whole kind of a combination of things that made us sort of anti-Eastern, I believe. We felt like we weren't being heard. And I think that was another reason why people that I was around anyway were so excited about Goldwater.
And one of the important Western leaders in the Goldwater movement was Frank Whetstone from Cut Bank, Montana.
Yeah.
When did you first become acquainted with him?
Well, somewhere in that area, probably 65, 66, after Goldwater's defeat, I went on to become quite involved in the Teenage Republicans and got to know Frank a little bit. Seemed like I kept getting invited to meetings where he was at. It was a very important part of the meeting. Back days, you know, you've heard the story about the smoke-filled rooms. I can remember as a high school student being one of the young people in these meetings where they were talking about strategy and how to get the conservative point of view advanced in the Republican Party, and you go into those meetings and you could hardly see from one end of the room to the other because everybody in there was smoking except me, and you just as a non-smoker I just never could quite get used to that that whole thing, but it was truly a smoke-filled rooms and people were just fogging them up like crazy, but they. Frank was at one of several of those meetings, and he was kind of an interesting fellow. He was always encouraging new people, trying to make the tent a little bit bigger to get people involved. And he would here he was a man, you know, he was a full adult here, and I was just in high school, but he took an interest in me and kept. Every once in a while I'd get a call from Frank Whetstone to let me know what was going on or to encourage me to go to a meeting that was coming up. And he wouldn't just call me and talk to me because a lot of times, you know, in our home, you know, my mom might pick up the phone, answer the phone. He'd take time to talk to my mother. And my mother never met Frank Whetstone, but she always, face to face, but she always said he was a nice man like that who took the time to talk to someone's mother must be a very fine individual, you know. But that's the sort of guy he was. He knew that a high school student would need the okay of his parents to be involved in something like this. And so he was going to pave the way. Frank always knew the secretary to get so that he could get into the to talk to the important person. And he made friends with the secretaries and the administrative aides and knew all of them and knew how to take care of them, and so that he could get what he wanted to.
And he was the classic example of the political activist.
Oh, Yes.
He was involved in Republican Party politics beginning when he was probably as young as you were when you became involved.
Yeah, yeah. His father, Dan Whetstone, was for many, many years the national committee man for the Republican Party in Montana. And Frank started going to Republican meetings, I'm sure, back in the 20s, maybe, or 30s.
Well, he told me one time that when Governor Joe Dixon was unable to attend a Republican, I believe, state convention, mm-hmm. sometime in the early 1920s, that Dan Whetstone, his father, of course, was a close ally of Joe Dixon, and so Frank had the honor of being able to carry, and even though I think it's perhaps a teenager, mm-hmm. carry and vote Governor Joe Dixon's proxy at the Republican State Convention. And that might have been like in 1922 or 23 or 24, something like that. So his involvement went back a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was involved as a Republican leader and a conservative leader for decades in party politics, and was he had a fundamental understanding of political organization and networking, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
He was the consummate people's person. You know, he knew people, and he was friendly with people. And even though he might have disagreed with you, been on opposite sides of you once before, he was always there to try and bring someone back into the fold or get them involved in his group, trying to broaden the group all the time.
And when Goldwater was nominated in 1964, of course Frank Whetstone was importantly involved, mm-hmm. as a leader in the Goldwater movement. And then after the Goldwater election in 1964, Whetstone was an important leader in keeping conservatives united and focused and that type of thing.
You bet. One of the big things that Whetstone was involved in was what they called the Draft Goldwater Movement. And the Draft Goldwater Movement was just truly that. It's probably the last time that there was an honest draft movement to get somebody nominated for president. You know, usually these politicians now have their egos so far ahead of things that they're out there testing the waters all the time. Well, Goldwater was a reluctant candidate. And Frank was part of a group that was trying to get him involved, and it, because of what they were trying to do to get a broad base of support across the country, Frank had made huge numbers of contacts all over the country in the Goldwater movement. So after Goldwater was defeated in 64, Frank still had all those contacts and friends in all across the country who he then called on to get involved working for another conservative candidate, which turned out to be Ronald Reagan eventually. And they were it was those huge numbers of contacts, I think, that Frank made during the Goldwater effort. And that wasn't the beginning of his involvement. I mean, he was very involved with Senator Robert Taft running for president against Eisenhower in 52. He was part of that group that was supporting Taft. And then he ultimately endorsed and worked for Eisenhower, but Taft was his man in 52. And so Frank's efforts went back a long ways, but the numbers of people that he met during the Goldwater thing, during the draft Goldwater movement, was where he got this huge contact base, so that a guy from little old Cutbank, Montana was very important, ultimately, in Ronald Reagan's convention victories.
And then Reagan was, I believe, nominated for president in the 1968 convention. He'd been elected governor of California in 66.
Mm-hmm.
And Rockefeller was vying for the Republican nomination in 68. Richard Nixon was a candidate for the Republican nomination. There were probably some others. I think perhaps Governor Romney, and mm-hmm. I don't remember for sure exactly who. Maybe Henry Cabot Lodge was still in the picture then. I don't remember. But Ronald Reagan also was nominated.
Yes.
And I suppose Frank Whetstone was involved. Were you with him?
Very much so. In fact, I had been brought into some of the meetings that Frank had to strategize to get some delegates from Montana. And the party structure was pretty much behind Nixon.
Tim Babcock.
Yeah.
Governor Tim Babcock was I think the first governor to come out in support of Nixon.
Yeah.
In fact, he told me once that that Nixon, of course, who had been defeated for president in 1960, defeated for governor of California in 1962 and considered a political has-been, decided he still wanted to run again in 1968, and he made a trip to Montana, probably in 1967, and stayed at the governor's mansion here in Helena. And in fact, I think Tim said that they served him salmon loaf, which was kind of an un-Montana kind of a thing, and he said he didn't know whether Nixon was serious about it or not, but he anyway complimented the salmon loaf. But anyway, Nixon asked Babcock to endorse him because he said Rockefeller, as a Republican governor, has most of the governors either supporting him or kind of feeling that they had to keep their mouth shut if they couldn't. And he was personally popular, apparently, among the governor's group. And he said, I just, you know, I really would deeply appreciate it if you could see your way clear to come out and publicly support me. And Tim said, well, gosh, I'm governor of Montana. I mean, is that anything that's significant? And Nixon said, yes, I think so, because I need a governor. And he said, I think if I had one stick his neck out, the rest of them, or some of the rest of them, may follow. And so I think there was a feeling of loyalty to Babcock in Montana that probably helped to keep the Republican delegates to the National Convention in line behind Nixon.
Right, and there was a lot of effort there, and we knew from our group that there were three of the delegates who were committed to Reagan, and it was kind of a matter of personal pride, you know, that night when they were announcing delegates, the press was saying who they thought was going to vote. And they were saying, well, Montana's probably going to have two delegates vote for Reagan, and the rest will vote for Nixon. And I turned to my folks and I said, no, there are going to be three delegates voting for Reagan. And my parents said, well, how would you know? And I said, because I know. And sure enough, there were three delegates from Montana that voted for Reagan in 1968.
Was Frank Whetstone a delegate to the 68 convention?
No, he wasn't. And I'm trying to remember the three delegates who. I can remember two of the delegates who voted for Reagan. One was Verna Green
from Bozeman.
From Bozeman, and now lives in Helena. Another one was Lowell Torkelson from Great Falls, and I'm trying to remember who the third was, and I can't remember right offhand. But there were three.
Now, Reagan wasn't the Republican nominee in 1968. Nixon was, and was elected. And the conservatives, while they supported Nixon, I think probably felt that Nixon wasn't really a solid conservative like they'd like him to be. There were some things that happened, like wage and price controls would be an example during the Nixon administration that I'm sure gave some angst to conservatives. And so Frank Whetstone continued to be a leader in the conservative movement, not necessarily a detractor from Nixon, but someone who hoped still to nominate someone more like Goldwater or Reagan. And in the process of doing that, how did he keep the conservative flame alive? What did he do?
Well, Whetstone, again, he was just always calling people. I don't know what his phone bill was, but even back in those days, he must have had a phone bill beyond anybody's imagination, because he was always on the phone. And as I talked to some of my friends who knew Frank, you know, Frank would typically call after dinner, and it might be up as late as 11 o'clock at night, but he'd be always checking in with his friends, just kind of see what was going on, encouraging people to stay involved in politics. The times he would call me, you know, I was transitioning from teenage Republicans to the college Republicans, and I'd get a phone call from Frank every once in a while, encouraging me to keep up the effort and asking me what I was doing and how could he be of assistance? Is there something that I could do? And I couldn't imagine that this older man, I think at the time, you know, Frank had to have been in his 50s, you know. You know, and this older fella had any really sincere interest in me. But he did. He would call up. I probably, all during my college career, I probably averaged maybe a phone call a month from Frank Whetstone. And I'm sure that there are hundreds of people around the western United States that got a similar call.
And this was going on. He was keeping the flame burning during the period of the Nixon presidency and the Ford presidency.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, Nixon was renominated in 1972 with virtually no opposition. But in 1976, Gerald Ford, who had been Nixon's vice president and replaced Nixon after the Watergate scandal, decided to seek the Republican nomination in his own right in 1976.
That's right. That's right. And it was a... just a minute here. Let me turn this thing off. Maybe I haven't got it off. Anyway, Nixon went to... Ford was running to retain the presidency. Reagan, I think by this time, was pretty serious. I remember the first time I heard Reagan speak was the famous speech he made for Goldwater in '64, as a member of the Teenage Republicans, and I was so excited about that speech.
Did you hear Reagan give that in person?
No, I didn't, but I heard it on television. It actually played twice. And it played earlier to a smaller audience, and then they gathered up a bunch of money and played it just, I think, the week before the election. And I remember being so excited about Reagan after having heard it the first time that I got a bunch of the kids in our Teenage Republican Club together, and I grabbed a phone book, and we tore pages out of the phone book, and we passed them around, and we were all going to call everybody on that page in the phone book to make sure that they listened to the speech. And that was kind of the beginning of my enthusiasm for Reagan. I was so sure that if everybody heard that Reagan speech, that Goldwater would certainly, nobody of any brilliant intelligence at all could possibly vote against Goldwater if they heard that Reagan speech, you know. And so I was sure that was the answer.
Tom,
so,
our light's blinking on the tape recorder here, and I think we're recording, but I want to make sure. Let me just stop
okay.
for a minute, and we'll... And so we're continuing our interview with Tom Rolfe, we're leading up now, Tom, to the Republican National Convention of 1976, and you were a delegate.
I was. It was my first time to go to a national convention. Had been elected a delegate, and there had been quite a struggle in Montana, because we wanted to send a completely solid Reagan delegation to Montana, or to the convention in Kansas City, and there had been quite an effort by the Ford people. I guess you were on the
Ford. I was one of them, yeah.
Yeah. And to try to split it up according to the primary votes that the two candidates had gotten. And if I remember right, it was like you guys were pushing for 7-7 and 13, and
yeah.
And we were pushing for a straight 20.
We had 20 delegates from Montana to the Republican National Convention. And this was probably the last convention, as we're doing this interview now, that was really contested.
Mm-hmm.
Because Reagan had won some primaries, Ford had won some primaries, Reagan had won some conventions, Ford had won some conventions, and the outcome was in doubt.
Mm-hmm.
As we headed up to the Republican National Convention, even in Montana, as late as our convention occurred, I think this was probably in June, wasn't it?
I believe so.
And so we had the Republican State Convention in Montana, and I remember Ford's surrogate to the Republican National Convention was his Secretary of Interior, who had been a congressman from North Dakota. His name was Tom Kleppe, and Kleppe then was appointed by Ford to be the Secretary of the Interior. And he was a personable guy, and Secretary of Interior is a major figure in politics. And so he came to the Republican convention, and there was a reception, and those of us who were for Ford were thinking, well, this was a real coup on our part to have a member of the president's cabinet to be there and actually attend the convention. And all, after all, we were just for 13-7 for unity.
Yeah, that, for unity. For I remember that.
The idea was that in the primary election, which wasn't binding,
mm-hmm.
that's how the percentage worked out.
Mm-hmm.
If you followed the percentage of Republican voters, then the Reagan people would be entitled to 13, and the Ford people would be entitled to 7. And so we thought, well, that's what we'll do. We'll go that way. But the Reagan people, you may remember, pointed out to me, I mentioned this to one of them, I said, this is just a unifying kind of a thing. You know, let's just be fair with each other. And he said, well, just recently, the Republicans in Minnesota were in a similar kind of a situation where Reagan won Gerald Ford won the non-binding Republican primary in Minnesota. And so there were a majority of Reagan votes that went to the Republican State Convention in Minnesota, and because the outcome on the national level was close, and the Ford people realized they needed every delegate that they could get, they took the whole Minnesota delegation. So don't expect us to do anything different here in Montana. We're going to just do the same thing. And I remember my reaction was the same as yours. I thought, yeah, I mean, I can see where they're coming from. So I pretty much knew the handwriting was on the wall. And then it particularly was the case when Ephraim Zimbalist, the well-known movie actor, and Ken Weaver, another well-known movie actor, who had been,
Ken Curtis. He'd been.
He was Festus, I think.
Festus on Gunsmoke, yeah.
And Ronald Reagan himself came to the Republican State Convention, and so we went through a receiving line, myself included, the Ford people as well as the Reagan people, and shook hands with Ronald Reagan and that sort of thing. And I realized, you know, if I had never before then, that we were being absolutely blown away on that thing, because Reagan's his celebrity was so powerful. He was such a radiant and charismatic figure.
Yeah,
that there wasn't any question about how that convention was going to turn out.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing. The grassroots efforts that went into our organizing our delegate hunt for the state convention was really pretty unique. In my home county, Gallatin County, we left our county chairman home. And did not let him, and it was kind of a hard thing for me because this fellow had been my dad's banker forever and was a very good
Monty
friend.
Monty Lockwood. Yeah.
And he was the county chairman, and we didn't even let him have a delegate vote at the state convention because he wouldn't commit to Reagan. And we got everybody who wanted to go as a Reagan delegate, who was willing to do it, to commit to support the Reagan slate. And when then we put a slate together, the delegates kind of on a grassroots basis selected their own slate, and whoever was on that slate got to go as a Reagan delegate. And we just convinced everybody to hang tough and vote only for Reagan delegates. And by golly, it worked. I remember at several pretty powerful people in the local community came and tried to get us to do a split there, and it didn't work. And here, and then the effort in Helena, where the state convention was, did the same thing. We sent 20 delegates back to Kansas City that were all committed to Reagan. Now, we weren't completely sure of everybody, but we felt they'd all signed off and said they would support Reagan. So that was a pretty big deal. We got down there, and even as the convention started, the convention was not decided, and so it was really tight. And there was a perception among the people that were working for Reagan that Ford or his lieutenants had promised the vice presidency to several different people, with the idea of holding those delegations for Ford until after the nomination. So Reagan made the strategic decision to name his vice presidential candidate early on, about a week before the convention. And the gentleman's name was Richard Schweiker. He was a senator from Pennsylvania. It always gave us a chance to break into into an important block of votes. And
from an eastern state that might be inclined not to go with Reagan.
That's right. And the other thing was, we thought that if Ford then was forced to announce his decision of who was going to be the vice presidential candidate, we might be able to pull enough votes away from disgruntled people whose hometown boy wasn't going to be named vice president, that it would make the difference.
Now, your feeling was that the Ford people were sending out feelers to a number of prominent Republicans,
mm-hmm.
making them understand that they were on the list, on the short list, maybe even at the top of the list.
And if they'd hold their delegation, then
it was a good chance that the governor so and so or senator so and so would be the vice presidential nominee.
That's right, and so this was why we thought it, with the convention as close as it was, if we could break through that and force President Ford to name his vice presidential candidate
before the fact
that we'd get some fall off from that and people who might be inclined to vote for Reagan on the second or third ballot might move us up to the first ballot.
So Reagan stepped forward and said, if I'm nominated, my vice presidential nominee, mm-hmm. or not even if I'm nominated, but I just want everybody to know that my guy is Senator Dick Schweiker from Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
And I think that delegates are entitled to know who Ford's is.
That's right.
And obviously the strategy was if he said Governor so-and-so, then Governor so-and-so, 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 and Senator so-and-so would be mad as hell because they've
been let out,
that they would then release their delegates and it would greatly improve Reagan's chances.
That's exactly right. And if you remember, the dynamic was there because Nelson Rockefeller had been named president under Ford.
I've been named vice president.
Vice president, yeah. I'm sorry, under Ford. And Rockefeller was not palatable to the majority of the delegates, no matter who they were for.
Yeah.
And so early on, Rockefeller had taken himself out of the running as the vice presidential candidate. He was a sitting vice president, but he would not continue to be vice president. And that's why there was a hole there, not knowing who was going to be vice president, and so that set up the conflict around the rule that was proposed by the Reagan organization, a rule change for the convention, which required the presidential candidates to name their vice presidential pick before the election was held to determine the party nominee for president. And I remember the name of the rule was Rule 51C or 53C or something like that, but that's what we were trying to institute this new rule. Well, obviously everybody who was lined up for Ford would vote against that rule, and everybody who was lined up for Reagan would vote for that rule. I mean, it was just, that's the way it was. And that vote to change the rule was to be held on the night before the nomination for president was concluded. And the vote was taken, and if 51 people changed their votes, it would have passed, but it went down by 51 votes. By the difference of 51 people changing.
And so the Ford people were actively trying to defeat the rule.
Correct.
Obviously.
Yes.
And the Reagan people were trying to get it passed. How would the Ford people argue against what you were trying to do?
Well, it had never been done, it was putting the president in a situation he shouldn't have to be put into, because that was never that was changing rule. If you want to change the rule from here on, fine, but the rules we've been living under are this, you know, so mm-hmm. that's the way we have to live under it right now. But the argument was just basically a stall tactic, because they knew that, I think they knew too, that this was a critical issue for them. And they really put on the power. I remember sitting in our delegation. Of course, the Montana delegation with only 20 delegates didn't take up a lot of space. But right behind us was the Pennsylvania delegation. And I had over the course of the events of the first couple of days of convention, kind of gotten to talk to a young man from Pennsylvania whose family was in the road construction business back there. And he was really on fire to support Reagan and wanted to do that. And so when it came time for him to that rule change, he was really somber that night. And I went to him and I said, what's the matter? You know, you've been kind of a happy-go-lucky guy. He said, I just received a call from my family, and they're asking me to vote against this rule change because they've been told that if I don't vote the right way on this rule change, that our family will never get another contract for roads in the state of Pennsylvania. And he said, so I have to, for my family's sake, vote against the rule change. And the young man implied that the Rockefeller family had that much influence in what was going on in Pennsylvania, that Nelson Rockefeller was directly involved with what was going on with that decision. And he was just devastated because he couldn't vote the way his conscience wanted to because his family's financial future was at stake. And so I know the pressure was on really hard. And there may have been pressure from our side that was equally as hard. I didn't want to think that our people would ever do something like that, you know. But I didn't hear things like that about our side ever putting on that kind of pressure. But that was the case. So anyway, when our delegation was organized, Verna Green and I had been asked to be the political co-chairs of the campaign, of our delegation. We were the ones to kind of be the whips to make sure that everybody was voting the right way to support Reagan, you know, through all the efforts. So we had to, whenever any item came up, like the rule change, we had to have somebody there. We had to check with each delegate to make sure they were voting the right way. And we had been going to strategy sessions at the Reagan Headquarters Hotel, which was then called the Alameda Plaza Hotel. And
this was where?
In Kansas City. It's now, I think, the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, but it's... I believe it was called the Alameda Plaza at the time, and we'd been going to strategy sessions over there just to make sure that everything was going the right way. And
Frank Whetstone involved in the
very, very involved, but he was involved a couple echelons up in the national campaign. He was involved with a fellow by the name of Andy Carter from New Mexico, and Frank. He and Frank were kind of the political heads, the convention headhunters for the Reagan effort in 76. And so after we had lost that test vote, really, it was a test vote on the presidential nomination, those of us who were the political chairs of the campaign were asked to come back to the Reagan Headquarters Hotel. And we sat around in very frank meetings. In our group was primarily the Western United States, mainly the Rocky Mountain states, and there was a couple people from each of the Rocky Mountain states in our meeting, and we kind of sat there just realizing that the end was near, that we were going to be 51 votes short.
The assumption was that vote on the rule was the vote.
That's
how it was going to.
That essentially meant the vote on the nomination for president, and if you'll recall, Reagan in 1976 was about 65 years old, so common wisdom was that he was as old. This was his last shot at becoming president. This was the end. Turn off. To the Alameda Plaza Hotel to meet with the campaign people, the folks that were just like one up the ladder from where we were, and the team leaders of the political directors for each state for the Rocky Mountain region were the folks that we were talking to. And we walked back into that meeting. Everybody was pretty downhearted because they knew exactly what that vote meant. The vote essentially meant that we were 51 votes short of getting Ronald Reagan nominated the next night. And by the time we got there, it was maybe 8 or 9 o'clock at night. So the guy said, you know, we don't have a good answer. But what the campaign wants you to do is to go home and think about it tonight. And we're going to meet back here at 6 o'clock in the morning and see if somebody's come up with a way to pull this thing together. Because we've got to find those 51 votes somewhere, or Ronald Reagan's not going to be nominated. Again, in the back of everybody's mind was the fact that he's 65 years old, and this is his last shot to become president, and we're all very dedicated to this man and what he says and what he does, and we think he should be president. So I went back to the motel, and a rather sleepless night, and we got back in the cab the next morning at 6 o'clock. I told Judy I didn't know whether Judy was there as an alternate, and my wife, and I told her I didn't know when I would see her, but that we had to do something about the situation. So Verna Green and I got in the cab and we drove back, went back over to the Alameda Plaza Hotel, and we sat there in our group and started kicking around ideas, and our group came up with the idea that nobody could sell Ronald Reagan any better than Ronald Reagan, and that somehow we had to get Ronald Reagan to speak in front of that convention. And just the power of his persuasive abilities, his ability to communicate, you know, he was always called the great communicator, that ability to communicate would save the day. And certainly there'd be 51 delegates somewhere that would change their mind.
At least that many.
Yeah, and maybe more. And we might win might be winning in a landslide. And so so how do you go about doing that? The order of the convention set, everything is pretty well lined out. To change the convention, the order of things in the convention, requires a change in the rules, which requires suspending the rules and a vote delegation of the entire convention. Well, obviously, the other side isn't going to be excited about having Reagan up there talking. So what do we do? So we came up with a plan that when it came time for nominations, we would ask the people nominating Reagan, and preferably be Senator Laxalt. We would ask him to defer to the former governor from California. And to do it, our thought was that if we did it in a way to make him look like he was going to give a concession speech, that it would slide through. Well,
so Laxalt goes before the convention, according to the strategy,
and to
nominate Reagan.
Yeah, and he says something like, I was coming here to nominate Ronald Reagan, but in the interest of party unity, I'd like to have the governor come up and speak. And the convention would demand that Reagan would get up there and talk and give one of his rip-roaring speeches and save
the convention.
Stampede the convention, because he had the power to do that. The power of the communication to do that. And we'd kind of worked out the details, we thought. Well, apparently nobody else had come up with a plan, or at least one that was viable, because pretty soon we were asked to present our strategy.
Word about what you guys were talking about had gotten up the
chain of campaign, and we were asked to present our idea to the next highest level in the campaign, which we did. And
that was who? You and Verna Green and some others?
There were about 10 of us from the Rocky Mountain states.
Yeah.
And we were asked to present our plan. They gave us a half an hour to kind of put some finishing touches on it, and then we went and gave it to the, presented it to the next level, highest level of the campaign, and pretty soon we were asked then to present it to the top strategists in the campaign, and they all kind of looked at each other, and the comment
now, went, now so you were selected as a part of a group. Started out with the Rocky Mountain region, went to a higher, and ultimately you were a part of a group of about how many?
Oh, of about 10 people that were presenting this plan for how we would save the convention for Reagan to the top people in the convention campaign group.
Was Frank Whetstone there?
I believe Frank was in the room. It was part of that.
But Ronald Reagan was also in the room.
Well, not at that point.
Oh, I see.
Finally, the top people in the campaign looked at each other and said, you know, this is the only idea we've got that has a chance of working. I think we need to show it to the boss. And so they arranged a meeting for us to go to Reagan and prepare and lay out our plan to Reagan. And so about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, after really having been over there at the headquarters all day, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we were ushered into the presidential suite at the hotel, and Reagan came in and met us all and listened to our plan. And he came in and says, I hear you have an idea that we about a way to pick up some extra delegates. And so we laid out our plan. And we were all pretty enthusiastic. By this time, we had been kind of moved up the ladder. We you know, in the back of our mind continually was this idea, was this is the last chance to, Reagan should be president. This is his last chance to be president, and we got to do something. We've got to do something to make a difference. We got to find those 51 delegates somewhere, because we're that close to him becoming president, and because we think he can win, and he needs to be able to pass to win this convention in order to win the presidency. So we presented the plan to Ronald Reagan, and then we sat, and he looked at us all and he said, you know, it might work. But he said, there's an element of deception in it, isn't there? And we all kind of looked at each other. And, you know, we had been so wrapped up in our goal of getting him nominated, that we had overlooked the fact that there was an element of deception in what we were doing. And he said, the next thing that he said was just amazing to me. He said, you know, the presidency of the United States is the most important job that I know of. He said that it wouldn't be right to start a campaign for the presidency of the United States based on deception. He said, now don't get me wrong. He said, I appreciate your dedication to the things that we mutually agree on, we believe in. And I appreciate that. And I want you to continue to be involved and to continually to work for what we believe in. But he says, I got to tell you, the office we're talking about is so important that it has to be done right. And we just couldn't start a campaign for the presidency based on a deception like what you're asking me to do. And we all looked at each other, because here we had come up with this plan to maybe change the course of history. But the man who would have benefited by our plan believed so much in the office and had so much respect for the people of the United States that he would not cheapen the process. He wouldn't cheapen the victory by doing it based on a deception. You know, I've thought about this before. Since then, I've thought, well, you know, maybe our plan really never had a chance, but we were led to believe it did. But this man was of such high personal character that he wasn't about to consider doing an immoral thing or a skullduggerous thing or a backhanded thing in order to get the job.
Even though he probably recognized, as you feared, that at 65 years of age, he probably wouldn't have another realistic chance of
That's ever right.
getting the Republican
That's
nomination.
Right. That's right. And the room went quiet. And then he talked to us a little bit about the things that we believe in and how important it is to work for them. And before he got done, there was only one set of dry eyes in the room, and that was his. Everybody else was virtually brought to tears with the recognition that we had been so consumed with trying to get this job done that we had overlooked what was right. But this man, who had the most to lose by not trying the plan, was the man who was showing us the right way. Here was a man who obviously had the moral character to be the President of the United States, who obviously had the kind of respect for the people of the United States that to do the job right, and he wasn't going to be nominated in the next 2 or 3 hours. He was not going to be nominated. We knew that. Reality was, the man who we absolutely knew had the character that should be president was not going to be nominated. And we walked out of that room, and he shook each of our hands, and it once again encouraged us to go forward and keep working for the things that we believed in. And the principles of free enterprise and freedom of the individual and more efficient government and lower taxes and standing firm against the communist threat, those were all good things, and they needed to be promoted. And he encouraged us to continue. But it was like he kind of knew too that he wasn't going to be the part of the process. And then the other thing that kind of hit me about it was, excuse me, I found out later through Frank Whetstone, that after the nomination was completed, that Ronald Reagan had personally called Gerald Ford, congratulated him, and offered his full support to do anything he could to go on the speaking tour for him or anything he wanted, and that Ford never once called him back and asked him to go on the campaign trail for him.
Hmm. You'd wonder strategically why Ford wouldn't have done that. It seems like that might have helped Ford.
I don't know. And I'm sure that there were hard feelings.
Yeah.
During the course of the thing, because it got down to be a Ford versus Reagan effort. Mm-hmm. And maybe they couldn't really get over it. But it was a really a sobering experience. Like I say, those of us in that room knew without a doubt that this man had the character, he had the strength of convictions, and as I thought about it later, I thought about it, and this man was comfortable in his own skin. He didn't have to become president in order to be happy with who he was. He was willing to give it up because rather than doing it the wrong way, he wasn't going to do it at all.
I remember a story in history about Henry Clay apparently taking some kind of a stand. I don't remember the details. That was destructive to his chances of becoming president. And when he was asked about it, he said, "Well, I'd rather be right than be president." Mm-hmm. And I think you saw firsthand mm-hmm. someone who, I don't know the how literally, you know, what exactly happened in Henry Clay's case, but in Reagan's case, from this experience that you had personally, mm-hmm. Reagan literally made that choice. I mean, he might have been the Republican nominee and he might have won the general election.
That's right.
But he felt that to do so based on a deception mm-hmm. was the fundamentally wrong way to begin the mm-hmm. the pursuit of the greatest office in the land, and he just wasn't willing to do it.
That's right.
Even when, in all likelihood, it was the last chance he'd have.
That's right. Yeah, he was comfortable with who he was. He didn't have to be president. But there was no doubt in my mind when I walked out of that room, in the just deafening silence as we walked out of there, with the knowledge that he wasn't going to be nominated.
How did the vote come out on the floor then? Was Reagan nominated?
Reagan was nominated, went through the process, but Ford was not.
Was it about 51 votes?
It was a little bit bigger than that by that time, and I think maybe people sensed that mm-hmm. they knew that was the difference, and they knew, and a new strategy hadn't come out to hold people together. I don't remember the final numbers, but you know, if you remember, in those conventions, once it's pretty well a solid thing, well then people start peeling off, the delegates start peeling off. But it was an amazing experience for me, and I don't think I really fully understood it until I recently read a book entitled God and Ronald Reagan, which talked about his incredibly deep faith. And I think that probably had more to do with where he was and his, than anything that else. I think this man had an incredible faith in God, and he was comfortable with who he was and his relationship with God. And I don't think that he had to be president to be happy. You know?
Tom, did you ever meet him at any other time?
Yes, I did. In about a year before that, he had come to Montana to do a fundraiser for the Republican Party in 1975, and it was in Bozeman. The effort was the speech was put on at the field house, and then there was a private reception at a country club before that. To raise money, and I had the good fortune of being his chauffeur the whole time he was in town, and so there were a lot of people that wanted to spend time with him, so every time we would stop the car, somebody'd get out and somebody'd get in to spend time with Ronald Reagan, and the thing that I remembered from that experience was, he was an attentive listener, he paid attention to people. And when asked to participate, when he participated in the conversation, he was an incredibly interesting conversationalist, and probably the best storyteller I've ever been around. He was trying to illustrate a point, and he told the story about the horse cavalry units that were trapped in the Philippines when the Japanese took over, and he told the story about how each officer went out, who had been assigned a horse, went out and shot his own horse so that the Japanese wouldn't get the horse. And he told it in such a way you could just feel the emotion of these people who were bonded to those animals that shot it. Another story he told was about the time he told about when he was filming the movie The Cattle Queen of Montana with Barbara Stanwyck. They were up somewhere in the around Glacier Park where they were doing it, and Reagan had been around animals when he was younger, and they were the movie set director was having a terrible time. They were supposed to do a scene in standing in front of a fence with a bunch of cattle in the back, and in the background, and these cattle had been moved around a lot, and they were sitting there mooing and creating so much commotion that they couldn't record the scene. And the director was getting all frustrated, and finally Reagan just got up on the top of the, climbed up on the fence and yelled out real loud, "Shut up!" And it caught the attention of all these animals for enough time that they could film the scene and record the words and go on. And he laughed about that, and he said after that I was referred to for quite a while in Hollywood as the man who talks with cows, you know. he would tell stories on himself, but a very engaging man and very sincere. It was quite a thing for a dumb kid from Montana to have the opportunity to spend those little times with him that had such an impact on my understanding of who the man really was.
What a story.
Yeah. Enjoyed it. It was an amazing thing. And, you know, I think when you go back and when you look what Reagan did in 1980 when he finally was nominated, you know, who did he choose as his vice presidential nomination? As his vice president, his primary competitor.
George Bush.
Yeah, he chose the man who he'd been competing against. His ego wasn't in the way. And he was able to bring the party together to work in concert to win the election by his ego not being in the way. So I think he was a guy, like I say, who was terribly, he was just incredibly comfortable with who he was, and was very sincere about trying to do the right thing. I think, of course I'm biased with that, the experience I've had, and as long as I worked in a small way for his nomination, but I think character-wise he's one of the leading people that have held the office. I don't think there are very many people that have had that strength of character that he had. It's been an interesting experience to be involved in politics and see the changes over the last few years. You think back to when I first got involved in politics. When I went to school and I argued as a conservative and told people I was conservative, I got ridiculed for being a conservative. Now everybody wants to be a conservative. You know, everybody has some, whether they are or not, they want to imply that they're conservative.
When we were younger, it was okay to be a liberal, mm-hmm. in the 50s and 60s. And now it's more okay, or at least in the 80s and 90s it was. I don't know if that's changing now or not. To be a conservative, and most people didn't want to say they were liberals, they were either conservatives or moderates.
That's right.
And certainly Ronald Reagan was critically important in that change in the political culture of the United States.
You bet. Yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
You bet.